Welcome, everyone. You're tuning into Paradigm Shifters. And you know what? This week, I've managed to track down somebody who shifted my paradigm in the 80s. Somebody whose book, Deathing, which is about the process or being conscious about dying, her book is called Deathing. It really, really touched me in the 80s. So I tracked her down recently. So welcome to the show, Anya Fuss-Graber. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's my privilege.
Well, since we started talking, I've realized that besides the book Deathing, you're kind of an amazing character, and you have a number of avenues in which you've explored reality. So let's first talk about Deathing, and then we've got some other things to talk about, like missing time segments and all kinds of interesting metaphysical things or consciousness things. So what got you to write a book called Deathing? It's such an unusual subject.
Well, I almost have to ask myself that. What a nice young mother of two preteens doing something that I wasn't qualified for. I wasn't a nurse. I wasn't a doctor. I wasn't a hospice worker. I didn't know any of those fields. I'd never heard of Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I had been, it was tone deaf on anything but literature and my own experiences.
And you weren't widowed, were you? You hadn't, and you had, you hadn't lost a partner or anything, had you?
No. Okay. No. I had no prompt except, childhood clairvoyant experiences that showed, I called death a birthday. And got run out of church by my mother, and I told it to the old gentleman that ended up not being there the following Sunday.
Oh, my
having
goodness.
Having his birthday, right?
What kind of a church was that, Anya?
It was a Lutheran church.
Okay.
And, and I always sat on his lap every Sunday, whenever I could anyway, and he's kind of like a grandpa figure. I didn't have a grandfather. And, I just told him that he was having a nice, he's going to have a birthday, and I was just so excited for him. And I didn't know any more details than that exactly, but I just, how kids are.
Mm-hmm.
And, he said, well, honey, little Anne, I've already had my birthday. And he said, I said, no, you haven't had this birthday.
Oh my gosh. It's your last one.
You're going to heaven. And he looked shocked. And
you said that? You said it out loud? Wow.
Well, whisper,
mm-hmm.
And there was having the procession coming in, and my mother heard, and I can still feel the pressure on my little arm, and she's kind of leading me strongly out of the church, because she was the, and I don't know what happened next. I was just so startled because I didn't understand cause and effect with grown-ups. By then I knew they were a little strange, but I didn't understand that.
And Anya, how old were you?
I was four.
Oh, okay.
Three and a half or four.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So he wasn't there the next Sunday.
Oh.
He had his birthday.
Wow.
So I didn't have much fear of death, but the original start to the whole thing was I was working on a chapter 10 of a novel that's still not finished. It's a reincarnation novel.
Oh, my.
And I was working on this chapter, and just boom, out of the, so that, we can't say out of the blue because it was the middle of the night. It was out of the black. But a picture formed right in front of me, and a voice override said, as I saw every possible way of dying, every possible way of dying.
Oh, my.
A cell's death, a star's death, old man's death, a child's death, a abortion death, a stillborn death, the earth's of various kinds death. I saw the earth, our earth's death. Saw Mars in its prime. The universe's death, I just boom, 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 and the whole thing must have taken maybe 30 seconds or 40 seconds.
Oh, wow.
And I heard this voice say, someone, not me, someone needs to make a construct between this world and next for ordinary people.
Aha.
A construct or a bridge, you know, because you're not getting exactly words. Because someone needs to make a construct. It has to be done, you know, a bridge between this world and the next. Over and out. That was it. And I just sat there stunned because I, open or shut eyed, I saw this three-dimensional, actually a holograph around me. I just saw it completely surround me. It wasn't just on a black and white or a color TV image. With my eyes, I tried to close my eyes. I opened my eyes and still saw it. And then when it was gone, it was gone. But the impression of it just stunned me for weeks, months. And I just knew I had to do it, but I didn't know what I was to do.
So you didn't even know where to start, I bet, eh? Where did you start?
No. Well, Frederick had left at that time. My ex-husband, then my husband, we had separated. And that had probably created a juncture where I could be fully myself in a certain sense. In a way, you can't be when a relationship is kind of winding down and there's concerns that pull you into the world. I was in the way that I thought I'd make my living in the future and also do what expressed that what was coming through me, since I had some past life recall. And so when this happened, I had opportunity and time without any calls on me but the children. Okay, so I'd see them off to school, and I'd pick them up at the bus, and I'd bring them home. So during that time period in between, I had opportunity to explore what was this. So I went to Yale, and I went to Wesleyan universities and the public libraries, and I got everything I could find on birth. And I started with birth and answered a few questions. I started with birth, and I heard the word birthing as used by, I think, Frederick Laboyer.
Yes.
Birth Without Violence, I think. It's somewhere, yeah. And then I read various other people who were transitioning from the 50s. Remember, this at this time, this is 1978.
Okay.
This is 1978. Transitioning from drugging women in birth to their consciousness being part of the category of called birth.
Yeah, kind of natural childbirth, right? Yeah.
Right. Then I got to natural childbirth. And then I realized what I had to do. I had to do the same thing for death. But I said, surely somebody else is going to do that, not me. So I'm just looking around, expecting it maybe to arrive on the front pages of a newspaper or in a magazine. Somebody is doing something. You know, there's nothing, nobody. And I had the sense during the vision that probably about at least 50 people were contacted at the same time.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Your book was really important. And, yeah.
Oddly, at the same time, and I don't know if he had a vision that led him to do it, but a guy that I was going to, who was eventually, as well as a friend, become my agent, a literary agent, John White, he wrote a book called The Practical a book of death and dying. At the same time, I was going forward with this idea. And we met at some viewing of a film on psychic phenomenon or something somewhere. We met, and that's how I happened to find out about it. And part of me said, oh, good, he's going to write the book. I don't have to. But we both discovered we had different books.
And so he published it for you, did he?
No. He was a writer and a metaphysics, a consciousness explorer in his own right. And it was his get-together with a school of psychic development that he and another guy had started. And these films of a lady that was also to become a friend, Elda Hartley, the Hartley Film Foundation, who later did a film on deathing for me. But in any event, her films were being shown. And we just talked I was really a student. You know, he was a director. And we started talking afterwards, and we united on our desire to share with others to remove the fear about death.
Oh.
We were united on that point.
Okay.
And I told him to share that death is a part of life. It isn't a negative part of life.
Mm-hmm.
And it is part of the, you know, the evolving process. And as he made it kind of cutely said, he said the revolving door.
No, that's
and
good.
So at that point, he voiced reincarnation in a way I had never heard it said before.
Ah.
And we didn't talk much. We weren't really close. And it was about another 13 years. Well, not that long, I guess. But it was quite a few years later when, you know, I called him to ask him to be my agent, and he agreed.
Oh, wow. Can you tell people a little bit about deathing and what it did? Like, it starts with the fact that we all die, but what is the process? Is it something that you teach people in the book about how to die better? I remember some meditative tools and so on, because I haven't read it for a long time. I just know it's stuck in my brain as a very important book. So I'm just thinking that you might want to tell some people what was in it, a little bit of what was
okay.
in it.
Okay. Well, first, may I ask, which of the two books about the same name did you read? Did you read the one with kind of a mauve, off purple cover, or did you read one with an orange cover?
Red, bright orange red.
Oh, okay. So you got the second one, the revised one, from 1989. The first book that got published in 1984, there are distinct differences between the two.
Oh.
And were I ever to write a third, I would certainly make it shorter than the fat one, the orange one. But the first one was actually secular, and one Norman Cousins endorsed it. He said it was a secular form. He was very uplifted by it. It was right before he died. And he read it on the way to the airport. His wife told me, you know, to endorse it. But I can't quite remember what he said of it, but he basically said it was a secular form of what usually religious instruction, you know, imparts. And he said it was a strong contribution to the 20th century. And in terms of the newly emerging death awareness field, that's what they called it in those days. So death awareness is where it fit. And then it was with a major small house in Boston, Addison Wesley, but it didn't take off by any means, you know, and it got remaindered, as they say, and I bought up the rest of the books and sold them off. They're about 4,000.
Oh, wow. But you sold them all? Did you sell them all?
Yeah, I sold them all, and they're all over the place. They're mainly in libraries. I got libraries that were interested. But when I got to about the last 10, I decided, well, I've got to get this back into circulation. So I started sending it out to different publishing houses. And there was kind of a tie between Bantam Books and Modern Library and Nicholas Hayes. And I chose Nicholas Hayes because of the editor.
Oh.
Who owned Nicholas Hayes. Because she said I could rewrite it. I could expand. And that was the magic word. I knew I had to add in at that point the spiritual process, which I had evolved in those 4 years to internalize myself. I had become a student of Satya Sai Baba, called the Christ of India, and I had formed about the different techniques of guru yoga, basically, where you say the name of the divine being that you're focused on in any particular religious persuasion, and they all dial central. They're very important for the departing being, and I wanted to share that. So I knew I had to go with Nicholas Hayes. They didn't give me much money. The other ones were very flush. And I turned them down to go with Betty Lunstead, who now departed. But she encouraged me at every level, step of the way, to do the next impossible thing, which is equip myself to write the expanded book.
Hmm.
And what it's about is it's different stages of relaxation of the body. It's also a story. It has a teaching story of a better way to die, practiced by the character Selma Riesesegg, a psychotherapist, and a very rich man named Tom Breacher, both patterned off of people I knew. And I kept the names quiet to protect the not-so-innocent on the case of Tom Breacher and the privacy of the psychotherapist, you know, that I called Dr. Selma Riesesegg. The word Riesesegg means climb in Norwegian.
Oh.
So Grace Klein is her code name. And Tom Breacher, well, he breached very clumsily the division between, this vibratory rate, this frequency, this realm, and his transition. And I kind of touched base on how it worked for him, because I was party to his death after he asked for help. When he passed, I didn't know he passed.
Well, what did you mean by the breach, Anya?
Well, he made through his fear, his ignorance, an accident death, and his atheism, actually, his lack of belief structure, his lack of making a bridge for himself, of having anything other than the physical. And if that's all you're focused on, it's not unlike the psychology that's been brought out through, you know, by psychotherapists who worked with LSD, for instance, and LSD trips. If your trip goes bad, if you have bad environment, your trip goes well if you have good environment. That could be an analogy here. So he made a very bad trip for himself in terms of not knowing anything and of consciously grabbing on in a car wreck his physical identity. And what happened is he finally, he got to his daughter in a dream to ask her help. And then her mom was able to get to me with the kid's dream the 2 days after I had gotten a phone call from her deceased husband.
Oh, you got a phone call from him? Woo!
I got a phone call from a discarnate who used the telephone line, so to speak, as a style of nervous system.
Wow.
To get electronically.
Wow.
Into a contact. And I mean, I had no idea that that even existed. Since then, I found out that there have been other people that have had this experience. But then I was just reeling. But meanwhile, we got between the daughter and the ex-wife and myself, we got him passed over. You know, we told him to go for the light and then the little girl, she wasn't so little, she was 13, but she then got another dream of daddy, and she said, I helped daddy.
Aww. So when you're telling about this fellow, the other interesting thing is several people have told me, you won't believe this, but so-and-so who's on the other side was trying to reach me by telephone. And you're telling me a story where he actually did do that. And that's a pretty interesting story.
Right.
So actually he got his communication through the telephone, right?
Through the telephone, which is the only way that he possibly could have, because we weren't close. I'm the last person I would have think he would ever call.
Mm-hmm.
And but he knew I could get him to, he had to go to light, he told me. I can't find the light. It's dark. I can't find it. Anya, come get me.
Uh-huh.
I have to get to the light. So he knew that much. And Gail and I surmised later that he probably was still in the near-death experience because he was being transported to Hartford Hospital.
Wow.
At the time when I got the phone call, and after his death, it's really late in the middle of the night, the little girl had some time to sleep, and then they connected with me the next morning. And since Gail and I were a little edgy at that time, you know, a friend, mutual friend from our spiritual teaching, came along kind of as buffer, mm-hmm. and then little Sarah just, you know, showed me the drawing that she had made her dad in a dream, you know, in a dream state. She said she drew him a map of how to get to the light, or how to get out, and it was very interesting what she drew. She drew a big kind of a Christ figure, but a big flower, and it was gold. And she put the darkness he was in, and then she put the different arrows toward this flower, and that he was supposed to follow that.
Oh,
and
my.
That she knew she had helped her daddy.
And how did she know that? Straight intuition, right?
Straight intuition. Mm-hmm. Still a child of 13.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm off on, I'd have to go back in my journals to find out all the timing lineups, because I adapted this for the teaching story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the deathing of Thelma and the Tom Breacher's passage, or whatever I called it here.
Mm.
But
the
whole gist of it was to make it available.
Hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about the process of dying, which you understood at the time, like if people are anxious, because I remember you taught a lot about meditation in that book as well, and chanting, right? Praying.
Right.
Right. So tell people Okay, go ahead.
I found out between the first book and the second book, you know, why I had to rewrite it, I had found out about guru yoga, or about the name of God at the moment of death, in whatever belief structure that you had, would be your avenue to put no more tangles on whatever state of being you were really in the physical or in the psychological.
Right.
That by focusing on the frequency of being of unification with higher consciousness than yourself, you were identifying, you were tracking with it. That's actually a word that I got from a Tibetan Rinpoche that was teaching. And he said, look, you hitchhike with a higher consciousness, even if you're unable to experience it on your own. Certainly at the moment of death is the easiest time.
Hmm.
And so the method I ended up focusing on in the Orange Book, in the Deathing Book, was guru yoga. I call it the fail-safe technique, or the sixth technique to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five, which, you know, goes through different stages of response to your dying process. And then you go into acceptance, and from acceptance, I took it into various stages of different spiritual exercises that you could practice, going to the light, pulling the light into the body, you know, rotating on it, and getting practiced to be able to be at that frequency,
mm-hmm.
training your attention. Because, you know, if you have time, that's the thing to do. Our society gives us no help whatsoever.
So what you're saying is, I think what you're saying, Anya, is that we can practice dying from this perspective right now, or we have no intention of dying, but we can practice.
Exactly.
Okay. Can you give us those steps again?
Okay. Just a second. I put forward six techniques, and after teaching a bit about the power of sound, the first technique is just be aware of the power of vibration and sound, and giving certain prayers. And I use the Gayatri Mantra, which I believe you've asked me about before.
Yes, I love it.
As a major way to establish a vibration in your own system. And I worked with the Tibetan and the Sufi Hum as well. Because you could tell an American or a Westerner hum a little in preparation, they'll remember that.
Okay.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So to set up a frequency in the body, that's the explanation of it. But it would be easy enough to do, lying in your back in a hospital bed or, you know, with time to practice. And to just get comfortable with that. Now, a byblow of this is very interesting, is that I've had letters of appreciation for the different steps of the dying process, of starting with this one. This is the first. Thanking me for a healing that they got. Cancers have been healed and so forth.
Wow.
Where they set up the different frequency in the body, and then the body shucked off its disease.
Yay!
And they didn't use it. So there was that was really it happened with the first book, even the secular one, because I taught the light exercise in it, and to my astonishment. And Desi Arnaz's daughter found that book in the dressing room of her dad, and used that level of the teaching of go to the light, dad, to help her dad, Desi Arnaz, die.
Hmm.
And, you know, she was very, very happy with that, and I heard about that afterwards. So, you know, it shows you that we need to be conscious of all the enormous power of reality to gift us here in the human form.
Mm-hmm.
And all sorts of amazing things happen. So I taught the second technique is breathing and relaxation.
Okay.
And the third technique is learning to sense energy fields. Now, these are not Kubler-Ross's, you know, exercises. I'm just using the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then added my 6. And sensing exercises, you know, and a dynamic meditation. I taught the Gayatri. And I taught the folks to, in my seminars, you know, to feel the blood pulsing through the system, then feel the energy behind the blood, the light that is charging through the entire system, and just to be attentive. And then I started teaching the meditation on the electrical body, which is a yoga technique I learned from Dr. Rumurti Mishra, and it's very effective. You follow the electricity of the system of the body, which is just a word, you know. Basically, you're sensing the pulsation of that which is inside you.
Okay.
And you just follow it. You follow it from your head to your tail, your head to your feet, and you follow it through your arms, and you become aware of it. And as you become aware of it, you get excited about the fact that it's so different. And in a dying person, you'll find that the skin of reality of their physical is very thin, so they're feeling their electrical body. I've had reports of people said they could touch it. They felt like you could touch it when they touched their hand to it.
Wow.
And they could follow the flow of electricity up and down, and like almost like radio waves, you can tune in through the electrical body to anywhere. And now, its relationship to the astral body, I do not know. I just find that we're having a higher etheric body, probably, in what I call the electrical body. But in any event, you could teach unity that way.
Okay.
And you could give somebody the sense of being part of the all. And the fourth technique would be introduction to visualization. And that I wanted to teach them. It's a cheaty way of doing it, but take out your contacts and your glasses and press on your eyeballs, and you get a retinal after image. And train your eye to hold it. You can get a dark image, or you can get one of pure white light. And it's a neurological one, but it's one you can train your eyes on. It's easy.
Wow.
And I wanted... And so it's mainly you have to train to light. And the training technique that is physical, that you have to have a little prop with, you take a 60-watt, I put in my book, you put a 60-watt bulb, and you learn to watch it. You just learn to keep your eyes open and watch it. And you start, then you close your eyes and you hold that image.
So that's a training, right?
And it's a pretty good training, and it works fast, and kids get it in a half a second.
Wow.
And but most adults, it's about eight weeks. You know, I usually give, if I'm teaching, working with somebody, that in the old days anyway, people resist it, oddly enough. And all it is learning to visualize an image. And then the fifth technique was the withdrawal of consciousness. We're using all these different things, the breathing and the sense of the electrical body, You would just do deep diaphragm breathing, and you begin to usually begin the ascent, so to speak. You start with your feet and your lower trunk, because the energy rises. And all you do is strobe it. Nature knows what it's doing. I mean, your soul is already on, knows exactly the departure from its physical vehicle. Mm. So all you're doing is being cooperative with the universe.
working with the energy, right?
Yes, uh-huh. And you're not doing anything. So that's what I tried to share with folks. You know, the death experience is like shucking off an old skin, but you, or, you know, getting born, and there's some effort to it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you don't have to do it. But if you cooperate with the process, you're less stressed. You're not in control. That's not really the issue. But you are cooperative.
Hmm. Well, that's really interesting. What's the sixth part?
Well, the sixth technique is when you use the name of God.
Okay.
Actually, I didn't do a very good job with integrating it here, as I've been told. My German translator said, "Do you realize you didn't put in the sixth technique for itself?" And I was shocked. But it's in there, but it's sort of sidelong. But you say the name of God as you're doing the withdrawal of consciousness idea. Before you're bringing it up, you exhale at the top of your head, then you inhale, and you start again at the feet and pull it back up. And while you're doing it, you work with the fail-safe technique, the name of God of your choice that you focus on. And the way I've done it is to put it, you hook it with the personality name. For instance, when I was working with my dad asked me if I would hook his name to Sajjala. He had finally, as a preacher's kid, he'd kind of waffled back and forth between what focus would he use. But he asked that be his focus at the end. And so I said, soul of Paul and Psi M1. Psi being the name of
Sai Baba.
Unified avatar, Sachi Sai Baba.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my mom, when she asked me, she was fond of Sai Baba because he showed up at her house a couple of times, and she's a very holy woman, and she had very, very, she went in high company, let's put it, this woman.
Hmm.
But she asked if I would recall her to Jesus Christ, because she said, that's the tradition I was trained in, and exposed, and I also saw it went in my with my father's death. Now that's an interesting story. She was only 17, but she was with her dad when he passed, and she went into the light with him.
Oh wow, good.
Can you believe that?
Yeah, I can. I hear
I've
stories like that.
I've never heard of that before.
Wow.
But you probably have.
But she
and
came
then,
back, right?
She met Jesus in the tunnel.
Wow.
And she came back, and she wanted to keep going with him. And she had her arms around his neck and was lying on his chest when he was passing. And you know, because he'd been dying for quite a while. He had liver cancer from overdose from x-rays.
In oh, wow.
Multiple days. Mm-hmm. Not that he didn't drink didn't drink a drop. But she went in with him and she saw the Lord. And she said, I want to go back to where I've already been. And use that call. So I did it with her. I said, Harriet was her name, Harriet, soul of Harriet, and Jesus Christ, am one. I said am rather than are to close the juncture between singular and original self, because these are all the symbols for the one self. And that was her choice, and that was my dad's choice.
So by this time, you're pretty metaphysical, aren't you?
Well, I try to cover it up in the book a bit. I try to not be too out of reach, but I really focus on the sixth technique.
Right.
Because if you, that's all you need. And that's all I would ever teach now.
And do you ever go beyond, like, for example, somebody told me recently that if you have a really hard passage, it usually means it's an opportunity to release yourself from a lot of karma. And my question is, often, like I think of, what's the name, Wayne Dyer, who died in his sleep. I always think that's preferable. But do you think people suffer terribly if they leave in an agitated state or in a mood or in an anger? Do you think we suffer more? I don't mean like hell. I mean like the going on with our psychology or going on with our emotional states.
Well, I think it would be preferable to die in a relaxed state and attentive. Mm-hmm. And that's where most people will reflex to God anyway. Aren't we taught the curse in God's name?
Yeah, really.
Oh, God. That's what people say. They're atheists. You know, mm-hmm. And they do it, and I've checked with my Muslim friends, too, and Hindu friends. They all pretty much cuss and pray in the same language, with except of, well, I'll skip that part. But in answer to the question, like Wayne Dyer dying in his sleep, the guy was a holy guy, holy man. I'm sure his dream state was acquiescent to his departure process. You know, but a lot of people, dying in your sleep is our conjecture of peace. But dying in a raucous dream state of effluvia of psychological process, that isn't really optimal. But if you're, you know, if it's on your ticket, so to speak, because there is a shelf life expiration for the physical body that we have with the incoming fertilized ovum, your days are numbered.
Mm-hmm.
The breaths are numbered. Your heartbeats are numbered.
Right.
Stress can speed it up. So somebody who should have lived to 90 will die at 71 or so,
mm-hmm.
if you know, given crash, you know, stress circumstances, you use up your breaths.
Mm-hmm.
And the yogis, that's one of their strategies, is to slow their breathing, to elongate their life so that they can have more time to practice,
mm-hmm.
you know, spirituality, is what I've been told. But in the anxiety... Let me just share one thing I know is, you know, I used to be very upset about that during the Vietnam War,
right
before I started working on this death book that drafted me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't choose it. It drafted me. I was terrified at thinking of all those poor boys in their cages and under torture dying. How can they, because I just had a dread of dying in that type of agitation, probably coming sifting through from a past life. But what I found is that there on the other side, there are areas of recovery, just like emergency details of beings that come and reach down. If you die in a hospital, the place is loaded with angelic beings and beings that take you know, crossover personnel. I mean, to see psychically, clairvoyantly, a hospital is a crowded place, let me tell you.
I know.
And it's wonderfully crowded,
mm-hmm.
okay, because there's lots of you know, benign help.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, because they know how primitive we are in our death process. I mean, people are drugged to keep away from physical pain, which makes them helpless. So then they have their partners from the other side. So I have less and less fear of people having troubles. But I have met discarnates, people on the other side, newly dead folks, in what I call a work I do in the dream state. When I'm called, I don't go deliberately doing it. I haven't hung up my jingle, you know. But I call it border patrol, where I find beings or drawn to beings that are in the no man's land and guide them in.
Oh, that's
great.
To
cross them into the light.
Good.
And to do that, to do that, usually the thing you have to do, and it's very, very simple, you have to find something they love.
Oh.
I've got a series of short stories I'll eventually publish called Untold Tales for the Millennium, but I tell of a really hardcore case of a guy that could not die well. He had physically died, but he was just a wreck. He was haunting his ex-girlfriend and wandering all over San Miguel de Allende, the Mexican village I was in, and scaring people to death.
My.
And, you know, looking half broken up as a corpse. And so I got drawn in to give him a hand. It was pretty scary, but I had to find out who he loved.
Oh, okay.
It turned out he loved a little dog. a little doggy when he was a little boy. And his selfishness and his beautiful good looks, his charm, his piano playing skills, his womanizing skills, everything had made him selfish for everything in the whole world except that little pooch.
Aww.
And so I saw his little dog, and I visualized it hard and told him his little pooch was waiting for him, and there he was, and I showed it to him. And he was able to let go here.
Aww.
And he clinged to the girlfriend, and he'd show up. And so it you must find what the departed person loves on the other side, if they're stuck. And because the belief structure that they're physical hangs on a long time if they louse up their crossing, so to speak. Because you want to make a clean break with the etheric body.
Right.
And see, that's what gets muddled with drugs or with, wrong thought.
Do you think people hang around for a little while to try to sort things out? Like, you know what I mean? Because I see a lot of people on the other side for the first couple of days, and they try to finish off something that they left behind. That's been my experience.
Yeah, I've had some of those too. Mostly I've had the kind of rougher ones, but I've had a couple of good ones where all they need to do is, and I've heard family stories from my mothers too, where they have to finish a piece of unfinished business or help their mate that's left behind. In my grandmother's case, the minute my grandfather was dead, the bank wanted to foreclose. But what my grandmother didn't know is my grandfather had sold some item.
Oh,
and
gosh.
Finished off his payments at the bank. So what the bank was going to use, this is, the 30s, that, what the bank was going to use as their strategy is you didn't pay your last payment. Well, he had before he died. But the papers were still in the desk. And so he came back and told her where the papers were.
Oh, my.
And so George told her where the papers were. She marched him to the bank and made that guy cringe. Because he was trying to rook a widow, And so I've heard stories of that nature. And so in that case, their distress was simply something unfinished that needed to have been done here. So I always urge, if I'm dealing with someone departing and they have some time ahead of time, is put your affairs in order. I just came from a seminar in Pueblo that I was a part of, and there was a wonderful lady there who was talking about a book that she has called Good to Go. And it's online. Like, Good to Go.
Oh, that's
and,
great.
And, she gives a list of all the things you got to remember ahead of time. And so her name escapes me right now, but you can follow the book, Good to Go. Some of your people might want to do that.
Yeah, and it's sort of like preparing for death, right?
Yes, to your question.
Oh.
yes, preparing for death, good to go. You want to be good to go when you go,
I love
this
that.
Is talking about, it was a conscious dying and conscious living seminar run by a friend of mine, and it was wonderful.
Oh, that's
and an
great.
Eye-opener, too.
Oh, wow. Well, we're almost at the end of our talk.
There are a lot of stories, though, of people doing... Excuse me?
We're almost at the end of our talk, and you were just saying there's a lot of stories of people doing what? Finish that sentence.
Okay. Yes, of doing all sorts of unfinished business with the physical world, so that they can just cut the cord and go. And many of them are charming. My friend Dr. Mishra, he had one more thing to tell me, and I was driving across country. He was a yogi and pretty well known at his Ananda Ashram. And he always was known, like several of the yogis would wear orange caps, but his was quite distinctive. And I was driving across country to go visit my sons in 1990 in California, or I don't know quite the year, but it was in the 90s. And all of a sudden I was aware of an orange cap in the non-driver's side, sitting there at the same height of a human being today. And it stayed there with me for the longest time. And what basically he wanted to share with me is that he wanted me to sketch down all the different ways of the cost of rum dying. And so here I am driving away at 70 miles an hour with my elbows on the wheel, scratching in my notebook the different storylines that he wanted me to write in this book.
Oh my.
And I did do it. Hmm. I haven't published it, and I'd like to finish it. It's called Untold Tales for the Millennium, because there are some very strong things we need to share into our time. Mm-hmm. That the last thought is terrifically evidential for any ambience that's created for the immediate afterlife, but also for a rebirth. So we really want to teach our society to be attentive. That last thought, the last conscious thought, is very, very powerful. So, for instance, if you're thinking of your wife in a sort of desirous fashion, and you're killed, let's say you're shot down as a young fighter pilot, you can be reborn as a woman.
Hmm.
I've had proof of that. And so there's a lot of this transgender confusion is because haven't we had wall-to-wall wars in the 20th century?
Oh, yes.
We've had violent deaths of mm-hmm. all sorts of people on this planet.
Right,
had,
that's true.
Religious deaths. And so we have had no break in terms of violence of many beings who just their lives got cut off and they have to go and pick up with, try to regroup them. Mm-hmm. You know, in the karmic patterns. So when, let's say they're supposed to die at 64 and they end up dying at 27
mm-hmm.
or 20, like my nephew did. He's mm. back as his own cousin's cousin.
Oh, cousin's wow, son, really?
You know, because he didn't get it all finished.
But you know what, Anya,
so
we can renegotiate our time of birth too, can't we?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And our death, to mm-hmm. a point. Mm-hmm. But there is such a thing as accidents happen, which I bring out in my novel, Horse Lord in the Island. I'll be doing a sequence of stories. They're all past life stories hung together, but it's accidents do happen.
Mm.
And when they do, then you renegotiate your rebirth. And, you know, I kind of did that this life myself. Because I, you know, the life before, I was just a 27-year-old woman in Croatia, in mm-hmm. Slovenia,
mm-hmm.
who died during the Second War under torture, and then should have a bunch of other things and didn't. So I just came back at an odd time. So I'm kind of an odd splice. Maybe I shouldn't be here.
I love it. Hey, Anya, I love that you're here. We have to say goodbye for now, but will you come back on? I'd love to talk to you further about like the role of spirits and also some of your own personal experiences that you had earlier than writing Deathing. You had some amazing experiences and we just haven't got enough from you yet.
Well, maybe by that time, if we wait long enough, I guess we'll have a book out. But look, I tell you, I'm so honored and deeply moved by watching the YouTube presentations that you've made.
Thank you. Because
I apologize, I didn't, if I had known about you before, I'd have been on your doorstep. But I'm probably kind of here in Kansas in solitary confinement of certain things. So
well,
I'm so
think
grateful you found me.
Me too, but Anya, I think living
I want to talk shop too.
Good, and I think living in Kansas is perfect for you because you're so magical about the dimensions and moving off the planet. And, of course, that's supposed to emanate from good old Dorothy in Kansas, right?
Exactly, and I'm still looking for her other shoe, though. I've got one. I'm looking for her other shoe.
Well, thank you. Anya Foos-Graber, thank you so much, my friend. And Deathing is the book we talked about today, but Anya is going to present other books and some very interesting stories she has next time she comes on. So thank you again so much and many blessings.
And the same. And to all your hearers and listeners and yeah. viewers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Good night.